Okay. Now, you said that Calling of the Crows is kind of a study of the after effects of loss. Did you find it cathartic putting it into music and song?
Yes, I do. But then for me, records like that that are really personal or about something really heavy, I find that I don't listen to it very often. It's like I do it and then I kind of have to put
it
away.
Once you get it out there, it's out there.
Yeah. But again, it helps a lot of people. I have gotten so many responses from this record in particular about how much it helps someone through grieving. Because they recognize so many pieces of that. And I think when people are in grief, it feels very lonely.
Sure.
So I think when people would hear certain lines or read certain lines and they would be like, oh, that's how I felt when my father died or my sister or whatever. They saw a piece of themselves.
Line or a certain song that people keep coming back over and over again and connecting with?
Well, there's one called Tears That Know Your Name. People mention that one a lot to me. And a song called The Roads of Time from that record that people also mention quite a bit. But the whole record really is just wall to wall. And it goes through all of the emotions. There's angry moments and there's very sad moments and there's hopeful moments and there's hopeless moments. And, you know, that's... Grief is so strange because when you're feeling things that intensely, you just, it's very unpredictable. And I am a fairly consistent, predictable person. So to be grieving was something that was very foreign. To grieve like that over a death, you know, I'm 35 years old now, so I'm just getting to the age where things like that are starting to, to happen. It was hard for me to feel so unpredictable, to turn a corner and be in a totally different mood or to be hit with those waves that hit you in those moments. So I needed to do something with that, and I needed to process it. And so that record really did help me to do that, and I felt much better. But now it's interesting because I listened to that record, and I always will think of then. And I don't feel like I'm in the thick of it now, so it is sometimes difficult to hear it.
Now, you mentioned Tori Amos. I know you've done a show, I believe, at the Wealthy Theater some time ago, just Tori Amos songs, and I'll see on Facebook, social media, that you'll lavish great praise on Tori.
Yes.
What is it about her, and what makes her music connect with you?
I think, well, I mean, I was a piano player and writing songs on the piano in the early 90s, and I was a teenager, and I didn't really feel like I had many artists I was listening to that were like me. I didn't really know where I fit in, I guess. Now, of course, I wouldn't care about that, but when I was 15, I cared about fitting in or feeling like what I was doing, that somebody else might be doing that. And when Little Earthquakes came out 20 years ago, I heard it, and my friends were like, you have to hear this record because it sounds like what you do to us.
Okay.
So when I heard it, I was just blown away, and I just immediately loved every single song. I heard like two songs in the friend's car when she was driving me home, and then the next day I rode my bike to Meijer and I bought it, the tape. And I went to Europe right after that for the first time, like 2 weeks later, so that record will always make me think of being in Europe. But I just listened to that record backwards and forwards, and I knew every word and every line and every song. I just thought was amazing. And I just felt like she was telling my story in some ways, and that's what good, you know, good music to me does. You find yourself in it. And so, and she, you know, she was 28 at the time, so she became kind of like, to me, an idol or someone to look up to or to emulate. And I just, there was something about her delivery and her quirkiness and her
She's very raw.
She is raw and very angsty, and it, that spoke to me at that time.
But it's a beautiful angst.
Yes.
Yeah.
And she's a beautiful writer. Her musically, I'm just still to this day blown away by her playing and her composition. And she's a great singer.
Have you ever had a chance to meet her?
Yeah, many times.
Oh, okay.
We were both signed to Sony at the same time, so
that's
that
what I was
helped.
Thinking. Yeah.
But I had already met her before that. But yeah, we had a mutual friend in a makeup artist named Kevin O'Quan, who passed away in 2003, but or maybe 2002. But he was introduced to my music by a friend who worked at Sony the first time I almost signed to Sony in 1998. And so he really loved my record Whirlwind Medusa that I had done that year. And he ended up playing it for Tori. And she really liked it.
Oh, fantastic.
So then I saw her. I went to a concert a few years later, and he got me tickets and backstage passes. And I had met her in like a meet and greet capacity when I was, you know, I met her in 1992. It was actually Election Day, the day that Clinton first won. I met her at the Kalamazoo State Theater, and I was 16. I had had my driver's license for 2 weeks, but that was like me meeting her at the stage door kind of thing, fanboy. Uh-huh. But in 2001 was the first time I actually got to go backstage and talk with her.
Okay.
And then over the next few years, you know, I got signed to Sony a year later, and so, you know, it's just a kind of a courtesy thing that if I would go to a show, she would have me come back.
Oh, that's awesome.
So, you know, I wouldn't say we're best friends or anything, but we're certainly acquaintances.
Sure.
So that was amazing to me to get to meet, you know,
well, it's
someone.
Always great when you have that opportunity.
Yeah. And she gave me a lot of advice when I was with Sony that was really helpful.
What was some of the best advice she gave you?
She, you know, it was good because we worked with some of the same people. So she would say, okay, when you're working with so-and-so, This is their tell, or this is how you deal with them. I found this person, blah blah. And then she just said, you know, you need to trust, and if they tell you that they need 3 more months, let them have it, because you don't want things to come out too soon if they're not prepared. Even though it's frustrating, sometimes they take a long time to get stuff done. This, that, and the other. She just, you know, taught me to be more patient and to trust myself or whatever. Not taught me, but told me to be, which was difficult for me. I was excited to be on a major label. I wanted the record to come out like now. I didn't want it to wait.
But when the advice is coming from somebody like her, I think that there's probably a great value to that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just thought, well, okay, she knows.
Sure.
By then, she'd been doing it for quite a while. So.
Correct. Correct. Now, a few weeks back, you helped bring J.D. Urban to town with his Everyday People Project documentary. I understand you have some music that's included in that.
Yes.
Wish I could have come to UICA to check that out. But for those who didn't make it, can you tell me a bit about the Everyday People Project? What that's about?
Well, J.D. Urban, as you mentioned, he's a friend of mine from New York, and he had heard my major label album many years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So he approached me when he was starting it. He started the Everyday People Project to pull himself out of addiction and like a very difficult time for him.
Mm-hmm.
He was a photographer by trade and
street
had started
photographer.
Yeah, street photographer. Mm-hmm. So people watching was his thing, you know, his business. So he decided to start videotaping people, and he would just find people all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And he was always a very inquisitive person by nature. He loved to ask questions and to talk to people. So he started filming interviews and editing them. And it was also, as much as it was a personal thing for him, it was kind of in response to what we have become conditioned to believe is reality television, because it isn't reality television.
True.
Those shows are corporate shows, and the producers manipulate events, and sometimes they're flat out just cast. I mean, they're
just
fiction.
Staged.
Yeah, staged. So he really just wanted to find people. It started in New York, all over New York, just videotaping people, asking, you know, in-depth questions. Mm-hmm. And he has, I've done now 3 interviews with him over time. He has a way of bringing out really, he can get people to talk about really sensitive, personal stuff that you wouldn't normally just talk about, but he's really good at that. And he asks really good questions. And so people just really started responding to those interviews.
Mm-hmm.
And so he started a web series with them, and he just, now he has the feature-length documentary version with the features, I think, 8 people, including Terry Johnston, the photographer from here in Grand Rapids, and me, and I'm in it. But anyway, he asked me very early on if he could use my music in it, and I said yes.
Mm-hmm.
So in the webisodes and the TV versions, one of my songs is the theme song that opens every episode. And then in the feature film, I think I have 8 or 9 songs in it.
Now, when you said TV version, is that on a TV channel?
I don't know. I know it was supposed to be, but I don't know if how that all shook out in the end.
But folks can check that out on a website?
Yes.
What website do you happen to know?
I think it might just be everydaypeopleproject.com, but it could be the everydaypeopleproject.com. I can't remember.
Okay.
But if you Google Everyday People Project into Facebook, there's a YouTube channel and a Facebook page, and the videos are edited a little differently. So the Facebook version is not the same as the YouTube version.
Okay. Now, did he record any folks here when he was in Grand Rapids?
Yes.
He did.
He recorded a number of people when he was here in Grand Rapids, which was great. He's always recording stuff. But yeah, he was at the Richard App Gallery. You know, they screened the film at the UICA, and then he had also a photo exhibit with Terry Johnston at Richard App Gallery. So during the afternoons, they had events at night for the public, but in the afternoons he was filming people at the Richard App Gallery. Okay. I did another interview with him then.
So those will be hitting the web soon?
Yes, yeah, some of them already have. There are a few of them that are up. So if you check out the Facebook page or the YouTube page, there are some people that are
so
up.
So folks who are interested in your music, where can they go to find out more details, Casey?
CaseyStratton.com is my website. Mm-hmm. Store.CaseyStratton.com is where my Bandcamp store is, which is a music service that a lot of independent musicians use. Of course, my music is on iTunes and Amazon and wherever you buy music, I'm probably there. I'm on Spotify. I'm on Facebook and Twitter. And, you know, any stone you pick up, I'll probably be under it.
Okay. This is Paul Jindrasiak for Sunday Morning Town Square, and we've been joined by singer, songwriter, musician Casey Stratton. Thanks so much for joining me, Casey.
Thank you for having me.